So, today we're going to talk about communication. This is something that we do a lot with quantum fields all the time in everyday life, but rarely we talk about in terms of quantum field theory. As in, like, we have Wi-Fi signals here, we have EduRoam when it works. So, this is communication through a quantum field, no? You have emitters, you have antennas, the antennas emit, basically interact with the field and leave some information in the field, and then other antennas take that information from the field, right? So that kind of exercise that is very well understood from the point of view of classical physics, the point of view of engineering, is not often that we talk about it in terms of quantum field theory and quantum interactions of atoms, if you want, or particle detectors with quantum fields. Which is interesting, right? Because usually you will hear when people talk about putting information in fields, there's a lot of intuition that people use, and maybe not all of that intuition is correct. So, you know, usually people say, oh, yeah, sure. They draw a space-time diagram and say, okay, here's, you put the information here. The information propagates at the speed of light if it's a massless field, and so on. We're going to discuss the nuances of this, hopefully between today and tomorrow. All right, so to set up a communication setup, what do we want? So we want two detectors, right? We want at least two antennas, one that is somewhere, I don't know, say here, and another one that is somewhere here, right? Like, I don't know, this is the light cones, and so on. So we want detector A and detector B to be somewhere in space-time. And detector A is an emitter, if you want. So couples to the fields and puts information into the field. B is a receiver, couples to the fields, tracks information from the field. There you go, that's what you do with your phones all the time. Okay, so let's set up the scenario. So we have two detectors, so the interaction Hamiltonian has two components, right, well, two terms. One for detector A couples to the field, detector B couples to the field. So basically, lambda nu is the label that identifies each detector. Lambda nu is lambda A, lambda B, they couple with different strength, right, possibly. They have different switching functions. So one of them is switched at some point with some shape. The other one is switched at a different point with a different shape. I wrote M here to talk about each monopole moment, of course, understood as this. MA is the monopole moment for A, and then nothing for B, the identity for B. MB is the monopole moment for B, identity for A. And of course, I'm considering here two detectors that are stationary and commoving. As you can tell, I'm using the time t to parameterize everything. So these two detectors are commoving for simplicity. You could do it, of course, with different states of motion. Okay, but for simplicity, let's consider them commoving. This kind of, here you just take your phone out and you have a Wi-Fi router somewhere in the room. That would be the case. You are both commoving. And of course, a couple, oh, of course, new, right? They couple to the field through the spatial profile, which could be different. And of course, the detectors are at different positions, x nu. Of course, the monopole moment is the usual form. And then what we ask is like, okay, we're interested in signaling. But the first thing that we need to do is start from an initial state and evolve in time. So let's say that we start initially. Let's take that the state is, for the system, rho zero, is going to be completely uncorrelated. So you just turn on your phones, if you want. So the state of the router, state of the phones, or the antennas, the state of the field, they're completely uncorrelated. So we take a general state, though, but completely uncorrelated. Yeah, well, I don't know, let's do first. Let's not particularize until we need to. State of the detectors. And state of the field. So here I'm assuming detectors and field start completely uncorrelated. Okay, that's the assumption here. Detectors could be for now in a general state. The field could be in a general state. The only thing is that they are just completely uncorrelated. All right. So let's let's compute time evolution, right? Step number one is we couple the detectors to the field and they evolve in time. So from somewhere here to somewhere here, right? They evolve in time, let's compute the time evolution generated by this Hamiltonian. So that's easy because we already did partially this thing. So we know that rho at a time t, capital T, yeah. So let's say this is, if you want, a time capital T. Rho at a capital T, it's equal, of course, if we do a Dyson expansion, is the original state plus corrections. Well, of course the corrections, as we know from previous lectures too, and from like basic perturbation theory, are of this form. Anyway, so this is rho 1, what I call rho 1, and this is what I call, and this is 1, 1, 2, rho 0, 2, plus rho 0, u2, dagger, plus order q. All right, this is what I call rho 2. All right, so let's see. All right. So we know what these things are. We know that, of course, we can write it here. U1 is minus I integral minus infinity to infinity dt h I of t, and then u2 is minus integral minus infinity to infinity dt integral minus infinity to t dt prime h t h t prime. And so on and so forth. So assuming that the initial state is uncorrelated, as I said, we can compute the final state as follows. The final state, of course, of so if we want the final state for the detectors, which is what we want, we know that this is going to be the trace over the field of u acting on the full initial state. Right, and we computed that to order two in perturbation theory a couple lectures ago. Even no, one lecture ago even. So this thing, it's equal to sum nu eta lambda nu lambda eta, and that multiplies minus infinity to infinity dt. Minus infinity to infinity dt prime psi nu of t prime psi eta of t times mu, well, I'll call it m nu of t prime rho d0 m of t, m nu, m eta, sorry. Then the Weidman function of t x eta t prime x nu. That would be the term that comes from the U1, oh, by the way, I'm not writing any terms. So, well, here's the thing. this is, okay, this is an extra something, let's say. Remember, I told you, so forget about this thing that I'm writing for now. And I told you yesterday that if the state of the field was diagonal in the fog basis, there was no first order correction to the state of the detector, right? Because this thing, U1 acting on fog state, if you are a diagonal fog state, generates something that is non-diagonal, strictly. And therefore, when you trace over the field, that's zero. Remember that? I told you that if the one-point function is zero, which is if the trace, if we know if the trace over the field of rho zero, of U1, rho zero is zero, of course, then when you trace over the field here, you get nothing. Okay, and when is this zero? Well, it's zero if it's a diagonal state in the fog basis. Okay, but here, let's not assume that. The field could be in an arbitrary state. So, no, there would be here, there will be for sure a first order contribution to the dynamics of the detector. Are we interested though on that one for communication? Let's see. What do we call communication? We're gonna talk about the ability of detector A to signal detector B. Well, we know that rho detectors, right, is going to be, I can separate it into two components, if you want. I can separate it into two components. You can separate it into, let's call it like that, rho detector at time t, one, and maybe I can take the lambda out. Well, no, I'll put it there. I call it like that. Maybe I'll write it like this. Sum over nu AB lambda nu rho nu. Maybe I won't do that. Sorry about that. Rho 1, okay, because I don't want to anticipate things. T plus rho 2 dt plus order lambda nu q. Right, you will have that in general. Agreed, people? Now, why am I not interested in this term? The reason I'm not interested in this term is because this term, rho 1, will be proportional to the lambda A something plus lambda B something. Right? If I trace the detector B from the picture, what I'm going to be left with is terms that depend only on lambda A. The same thing. If I trace detector A, and the reason is if I trace detector A, rho 1 is going to contain only things that are proportional to lambda B. Why so? Well, because it's first order. First order, the only thing that you can do is the field can talk to one detector only, and the detector can talk to the field. But at second order, it cannot happen that detector A talks to the field, and that perturbation of the field talks to detector B. That's a second order thing. You need to couple twice for that. Agreed? So there is no signaling terms in row one detector. Agreed, people? It could be whatever, but to signal from one detector to another, you need to talk to the field twice. First, A talks to the field. Second, B talks to the field. Then if not, there's not communication, and that's a second order process. Agreed? So that's why we don't care right now about the row one, the correction, row one detector, time t. So instead of that, let's call it, let's just talk about row two, detectors t, which is of course the trace of, I could have just written it on top, I'll write everything. U1, rho 0, trace over the field, U1 dagger, plus U2, rho 0, plus rho 0, U2 dagger. Okay, that's the second order correction to the detector states. Agreed, people? And this is what's going to contain the leading order signaling. All right? OK, so let's continue expanding. Then this is similar to what we computed yesterday for the entanglement harvesting case, if you remember. So we keep computing. We get the Wyman. The Wyman comes from tracing over the field. OK? Wyman of the state row. And this is the U1, U1 term. You can quickly identify that by the fact that I'm integrating over the whole domain, R2. It's not a nested integral in T. And then I also get minus, try to write it here, minus integral minus infinity to infinity dt, integral minus infinity to infinity dt prime, oh, sorry, infinity to t dt prime. And then we get the following. Multiplies a big thing, which is chi nu of t, chi eta of t prime. And that multiplies, I can put the parentheses here. That multiplies mu nu, and this is important, of t, mu eta of t prime. Right. Rho d0, and then the Wyman of t x nu t prime x eta. Plus rho d0 mu eta t prime mu nu t w to the Wyman of t prime x nu t x eta, sorry, x nu. There we go. This is the bit that comes from the U2 evolution, the one with the nested integrals. And I did a change of variables to factor out the swapping the names to factor out the switchings. All right. So of course, this Wyman that I brought here is not quite the Wyman, if you remember. It's the pullback of the Wyman on the trajectory detectors, which happens to be smeared in space. So this W that I wrote is, maybe I should have used a calligraphic W. Maybe let's use a calligraphic W, not to confuse it with the Wyman function. If you want, you can call it the smear Wyman.
Why in one line do you
can't hear you.
Why in one line do you write in terms of the amps and the other one in terms of?
Oh, because I made a mistake, thank you. It's because I'm used to writing mu for everything, but I wanted to make sure I separated tensor product structure this time. Sorry about that, and thank you. This Wyman is t x nu t prime x eta. This is the integral rn dn x, integral rn dn x prime of f nu, well, f is the same f that I
call it differently, right? Yeah.
F nu x minus x nu f x prime eta minus x eta, and then of course the real Wyman, the Wyman function, which is the trace over the field of phi t x phi t prime x prime rho phi 0. Okay, so this is, if you want, the smear Wyman, or the pullback of the Wyman function along the smear geodesic of the detector. Question so far. This is similar to what we did yesterday. And the only difference is that yesterday this thing was 0, identically, remember? Because we started from state of 0, 1 point function. In particular, we started from the vacuum, which is diagonal and in the Fock basis. And after acting with U1 became non-diagonal, therefore traceless. So this thing was 0. Now it's not. Now we have a general state of the field. I didn't make any assumptions, remember, on the state of the field. It's a general state. Questions? Yep.
This is a little late for this question, but can you, when you say pullback, can you specify what are the spaces that are being mapped?
Yeah. This is a way of speaking, but pullback means that, okay, I'm talking about that because I'm mixing the, you have a, in flat space time doesn't really matter. If you were in curved space time, what you're doing here is pulling things to the tangent spaces of the trajectory to the trajectory of the detector. So you have objects that are kind of global, that are defining the whole manifold, like the Wyman function, if you want, point by point, but you're pulling it back to the tangent space of every point in the trajectory of the detector. Now, that's a little bit picky, being, but we still use it. We call it pullback. To distinguish it from the Wyman, right? The Wyman is usually evaluated at any point in space-time. Is the Wyman is certainly an object that is a function of points in space-time. It's a function that takes two copies of the space-time. When you write in a detector, you have the Wyman evaluated on the trajectory of the detector. So it no longer depends on Tx, T prime, X prime. It just depends on a parameter tau that is the proper time of the detector. So you are pulling it back to the tangent space of the detector parameterized with this tau. So that's why. A good one, yeah. I mean, I use that because I'm used to calling. Sometimes, you know, the names prevail even if you are not caring that much about where they came from. Questions about that? No, but that's a cool question. Questions about that? All right. So where were we? Oh, yeah, here. So let's make more assumptions, right? Let's say, OK, fine. So this row 2, so we find that this row 2 detector at time t is going to be equal to lambda a lambda b times some row 2 that I'm going to call signal, and then 1. Goes with the square of the coupling strength, so that I'm going to call rho noise. So you see, I'm decomposing. Okay, there's a part here that depends on, let's say, lambda a square or lambda b square, but again, that's not signaling. This is detector b doing something to the field and filling it again, if you want. Same with lambda a, that's non-signaling, that's a local term. Is detector a doing something to the field and filling it again, if you want. But there are terms that mix lambda A, lambda B. Those are the terms that we're interested in. Those are the terms that in which A does something to the field, a leading order, and B grabs that something from the field, if you want. So this is the leading order signaling. This is the first term that is genuinely signaling in the perturbative expansion of the time evolution of detectors A and B. Agreed, everyone? OK. So we're going to focus on this, on rho signal. You see, if the local terms, when the lambda b, lambda a disappears, it will not affect the local terms of lambda b. OK, you make the coupling of lambda a 0. All right, so let's make an assumption that to simplify a little bit the calculation. So you don't need to make this assumption to find the result that I'm going to find in the end, but it simplifies the calculation quite a lot. Basically, we have a nested integral here, and that could be a bit nasty. It's not really. You can actually play with it, use some properties, and do a change of variables that denest the integrals, and you can do the things as usual. It just becomes a little bit long. So let me make a simplifying assumption that is true in many cases. The assumption that I'm going to make is that the assumption now. The support of the switching function for A. I know, maybe I shouldn't write the argument. I won't write the argument. The support of this is the set TA on TB, a TA off. All right, so first thing, we have a compactly supported switching function. I mean, that is, if you want to test causality properly, you better pick compactly supported functions, F and T, because you don't want tails to overlap and so on. You want to do a clean analysis. So let's take the switching to be compactly supported. and the support of psi b is, of course, t on b, t off b. And the extra assumption that we're going to make is that t on b is strictly larger than t of a. So the two switching don't overlap in time. OK? This is a simplifying assumption. So someone, as I wrote it there, someone sends a message. This is one, that picture that I draw here is one case of those. Basically, the switching functions are displaced with respect to each other. They don't overlap. OK, again, you don't need to do it to get the results. But for this calculation, let's do it. Questions about that? Yep.
So in the first week, you were talking about the problems with applying measurement postulates directly to a field.
Yep.
And applying it in a patch. Does coupling it to a detector in a compact region like this avoid those problems?
100%.
Are we going to see why?
No. Okay. If you want to see why, though, there's a paper, relatively recent paper by Chris Fuster. I forgot the co-author, though, and that is sad because I usually. Anyway, so there's a paper by Chris Fuster. It's an algebraic quantum field theory kind of paper. But Chris Fuster considers, okay, let's see what happens when you couple. He does a more general thing than coupling on detector. He couples fields to fields, which generalizes this. Okay, you see, this is a monopole field, if you want. And sees what happens if the assumptions are more or less, roughly speaking, you can do, to measure the field, you can do two things. You can couple other fields, generally, any coupling that you want. And you can do measurements on the other field. So you have a detector field, if you want, and you have the field you want to measure. And he proves that the things that are inherited in the theory for the field, the POVMs that derive from that, are fully respectful with causality and no problem. So that is rigorous proof there. It's a dense kind of paper, but it's a nice paper to read. Chris, I'll write the name here. Probably Christopher Fuster. That's the way he would sign. He's in York, in the UK, and he does algebraic quantum field theory. I like that paper a lot. But yeah, that's a really great question. Yes, as I said the first day, and let's put it like this. Coupling detectors and doing measurements of detectors do not destroy the causality of the theory. We will see an example of that. We're going to do that, and we're going to see if you can signal with these kind of setups. Okay, and you'll see that you can't. It's very easy to see that you can't if your theory is causal, as we will see in the result. More questions? Oh, so to answer to your question, we're going to see why in a particular example. Here we're going to see definitely why this does not create problems with causality, definitely. And we're also going to see why, we're not going to see in general that coupling detectors in any general scenario will do it, but this paper does it. No problem. Okay, so with this assumption here, we can simplify a lot because we can denest automatically the integrals. That's basically why I did that. And then we can group everything together in a very simple form. Under those assumptions, the signal part for the detector, is it called a signal? Yes. Is integral minus infinity to infinity dt. Integral minus infinity to infinity dt prime. And then you get psi a of t, psi b of t prime. And then that multiplies two terms, the smeared Weinmann, t xb prime, sorry, t prime xb, t xa. And that multiplies m a of t rho d 0 m b of t prime minus m b of t prime m a of t rho d 0. And you get another term plus the smear Weinmann T XA T prime XB of, I'm multiplying MB of T prime MA, sorry, rho zero, did I do? Yeah, I do the U2 first. Rho D zero MA of T minus rho D zero right. Mu, oh sorry, M A of T M B of T prime. So this is a term coming from the U1 U1, this is a term coming from the U1 U1, this is a term coming from the U2 rho zero, this is the one coming from the rho zero U2. And I rearranged it like that. Having this non-overlap support in coordinates TX for the switchings allow me to just factor everything into one integral. All right then, so we're gonna make an extra assumption here. And the extra assumption is, so again, this is the leading order term to signaling. And what we want now is to compute the contribution to detector B of, so what is the leading order contribution to rho B at a time T proportional to lambda A to some power. Okay, so this is the truly signaling term. It's like, okay, if I look at rho B at the end of the interaction, is there any information about rho A, the state of rho A, or the fact that A even coupled at all? So terms that are proportional to lambda A. Terms that tell about the story that A coupled to the field, and now I felt it through lambda A, lambda B, okay? So what we are asking is rho to only B signal, which is trace with respect to A of rho 2 signal. So I want to trace detector A. And let me assume an initial state now. So this is assuming a general state for the two detectors and a general state for the field, only that they're uncorrelated initially. Let's also assume that the detectors are initially uncorrelated. You switch on your phone. And then, of course, the router in the room will be uncorrelated from the state of your phone if you switched it on, okay? Or you bought it, let's say it's a new one, or something like that, to make sure they're not correlated at all. All right, so then assumption, rho AB, or rho D, as I call it, zero, is rho A zero tensor rho B zero. Still general states, but just completely uncorrelated. All right, so what one gets is that rho to B signal under those assumptions is the integral dt dt prime on R2, if you want. And then you get the two switchings. T, B, T prime. And then I get the trace of M, A, T, rho A times twice the imaginary part, twice I, the imaginary part of the Smear-Weinmann. And here we have the commutator of M. Yeah, it doesn't matter. I can write mu's now, which is so nice, because then I won't forget. The commutator of mu B of T prime with rho B. Well, of course, we've used that the Weinmann when you swap the arguments, it's the complex conjugate. Okay, and of course, that's a property of this Wyman, but everything here is real, so it's also a property of this mere Wyman. So far, so good? Questions? All right. Well, that's nice, though, because if you recall, we can take, for now, I mean, let's not do it yet, but what we, for now, we let's see if this works all the way. Oh, I already finished here. Okay. Let's take a basis of matrix representation. After all, these are qubits, and now we have only one one detector, so this is a two-dimensional Hilbert space, right? So might as well represent it with a matrix representation. Let me just pick a matrix representation. Matrix representation. And I call G, I represent this, and forgive me for the equal sign, 1, 0, E, 0, 1. Again, of course, this is not an equal sign, it's the representation of, but you know what I mean. And that means that mu nu is 0 e to the minus I omega eta t e to the I omega eta t 0. All right. So the initial state, if you want, rho d 0 is of course, it was the tensor of rho is 0, rho v 0. So let's pick a general state, as I said. So we're going to have alpha a, beta a, beta a conjugate 1 minus alpha a tensor. And this tensor here means Kronecker tensor, if you want, Kronecker product, the representation of the tensor product given by the Kronecker product. Alpha B, beta B, beta B star, 1 minus alpha B. So as you can tell, those are general states of qubits that I wrote there. Of course, there are constraints on these guys, right? This guy has to be between 0 and 1, and this has to be such that the matrix are positive definite. Okay, so it's not that they can be anything, but this is the most general states that you can have. And of course, using this representation is super easy, or any way you want. It's very easy to compute, but with this representation, it's super easy to compute that the trace of M A, or mu A, as I call it here, mu A T rho A B, rho A, which I have in this equation, is just twice the real part of beta A e to the I omega at. And then also that the commutator that I need here, let me just write it here, the commutator of m mu b t prime rho b, rho a 0 by the way, rho b 0, it's equal to minus 2i imaginary part of beta b e to the I omega b t prime. Here I have 2i imaginary part of beta b e to the I omega b t prime. And then here I have e to the minus I omega b t that multiplies 1 minus 2 alpha b. And here is the conjugate of that, right? Oh, interesting fact that you probably realize and you probably know, but it's good highlighting, because remember that I told you that in some papers, the initial papers of harvesting, they did an inconsistent perturbative expansion? Because they did an inconsistent perturbative expansion, they end up with density matrix that are not trace one. And in some papers that followed up after that, they renormalized the density matrix to make trace one. I don't know, I don't want to say anything. I don't know what you were thinking when you were doing that, but they do that. And the reason, I think the rationale is like, well, I'm doing perturbation theory anyways, So yeah, the violations of the trace are higher order. Well, yeah, they're higher order because you're mixed in higher order terms with your student, but they are, and then they're renormalized. Of course, that changes the results completely. The original papers don't renormalize, so still fine, even though they have an inconsistent term. They compute everything to the second order, and therefore the mistake kind of is irrelevant. But when people use those papers and renormalize the density matrix, my goodness. So if you see that thing happening, it's not OK. But you can tell here, though, that the corrections are traceless. Of course they're traceless. That's what the Dyson expansion does. At every order in perturbation theory, the trace is preserved. So of course, the initial state will have trace one, and the corrections at a given order are all traceless, as it should be. Just to keep in mind. That's what the Dyson expansion does for you. The evolution is not unitary at a given order. The trace is preserved, though. If you want expansions that preserve the unitarity at a given order, you can have them. They won't preserve the trace, the living order. If you want expansions that preserve the volume of phase space at a given order, you can have it. That's the Magnus expansion that you may have seen, the one on commutators instead of products. That one, yeah.
Which one is the one that preserves unitarity?
I don't remember the name. Sorry about that. Again, depending on what kind of thing you want, if you want to have that feature, then you can find an expansion that does that for you. But you can't do all of them at the same time. So in particular, if you do this one, you will not be preserving volume of phase space or unitarity. OK? That's what the Dyson does for you, though. It's very convenient, though. You preserve the trace, so that's nice. You have probabilities adding up to one at all orders in perturbation theory. OK, more questions or anything, or any questions? Just remember that. Right, so the cool thing, though, is that let's call this matrix. Do I have an I? I'm missing an I. Sorry about that. Yeah, an I in there. Oh, no, no. No, the I is not in there. The I comes from this side. My bad. So you see, what we have here is you can put the 2i if you want outside of the integral. You can put the 2 of the real part outside of the integral. You get a factor 4. Then you get this real part of beta a, e to the I omega a t. And then you get an I that I can put inside. I can pull inside of this just to make it nicer, right? That I cancels the I, and I put the I's on the non-diagonal terms. And I get the imaginary part of the Weinmann function. Oh, what was that? The imaginary part of the Weinmann function, I put it inside the integral. This is real, so that the imaginary part gets all the way through and hits the Weinmann. Oh, what was the imaginary part of the Weinmann? Who remembers that? Anyone? The Pauli-Jordan. Indeed, the imaginary part of the Weinmann is the expectation value of the commutator. So look at how nice. Rho 2 signal, it's equal to, well, it's 1 over 2i, the expectation value of the commutator, if you remember. So canceling all the factors, it's 2 integral minus infinity to infinity dt, integral minus infinity to infinity dt prime, xi at, xi bt prime, of course, the real part of beta a, e to the I omega a t. And I'm going to call this thing c of t t prime. And I'll define it in a second. And then you get the matrix minus 2 imaginary part of beta b, e to the I omega b t prime. And then you get minus I, e to the minus I omega b t prime 1 minus 2 alpha b. And then you get 2, the imaginary part of that thing. And here you get the conjugate of that. I'm just not going to write the whole thing. And this ct prime is the pullback of the commutator on the trajectory of the detectors, on the smear trajectory of the detectors. So x minus xa, F. So let me call it U1 FA FB X minus XB prime. And then times the expectation of the field commutator on the state row field. Well, look at this. If my detectors are space-like separated, say compact support smearing, compact support switching, right? What happens if my detectors are space-like separated throughout the interaction? So let's say on the support of, so you know, for this thing to be non-zero, you need to integrate over the support of the switching, over the support of the smearings, and over the support of this object. Agreed, everyone? If one of them, if you are outside of the support of one of them, this integral will be zero. So when you're space-like separated, you may be integrating on the support of the switchings. Definitely, you're integrating the whole domain, so you're going to definitely run through the support. You're going to integrate over the support of this, but everything that is not in that support is zero. And then if the commutator is also zero in that support, then this term is zero. So whenever the detector, this is identically zero if space-like separation. There you go, your answer. You get causality. There's no way with this kind of measurements, you will not be able to tell that detector A did anything to the field if detector A did it space-like separated from the region of space-time where A interacts. If you want the size of the smearing and the size of the switching, is space-like separated from the size of the smearing and size of the switching of detector B because of the support of the commutator. Any questions? So you see, if the theory is micro, this is the commutator. If the theory is microcausal, meaning like the commutator is zero for space-like separation, there's no communication whatsoever possible. And the leading order communication term comes through expectations of the commutator. In fact, you can prove in all orders of perturbation theory, there are, of course, commutators, right? You can prove it in general. This is the leading order. Questions? Notice, by the way, what is required in the energy eigenbasis of the detectors to get this term not equal to zero. It's required that the coherences are non-zero. If the coherence of, at least one of them, so if the coherences of BA are zero, for example, this term will be zero leading order. Agreed, everyone? So that already tells you, how do you think about communication, people, between detectors? The communication you probably think of, most of you anyways, is a detector is in the excited state, gets the excited to the ground state, emits a photon, that photon travels, and is absorbed by the detector B, right? And gets excited. What order of perturbation theory is that process? Can you tell me? What order in perturbation theory is getting the excited? Let's say first the first, the excitation. Getting the excited. Probability. Order one? No. It's order two. Remember, this state is diagonal in the energy eigenbasis. When you trace out that to compute probabilities, that will give you a leading order two. An emission process, as we computed here, that's the vacuum excitation and vacuum de-excitation. Remember, just swapping the sign of omega. These things are second order, mostly. So emission is a second order process in probabilities. First order in amplitude, that's maybe what you're thinking, because when you think Feynman diagrams, you think in amplitude, it's not probability. The process of absorption is also second order. So the full process where you have an emission and an absorption is fourth order in probabilities. Emitting a photon and capturing that photon is fourth order in the coupling string, probability-wise. That means it's extremely unlikely. We have to send a ton of photons. Atoms are extremely inefficient capturing those photons, right? Coupling strength is small. So what you're seeing here is not that mechanism. If you write it diagrammatically, this is certainly not an emission of a photon and a capturing of that photon by the other atom. This is something else. We will discuss that. This is part of the discussion we will have tomorrow. But before that, let's switch to the, can we get the screen quickly? maybe the screen. Yeah, thank you. So if it's not the usual picture where you emit a photon and you capture a photon, what is it then? Let me just do one thing. Okay, hold on. I'm gonna go directly. Yeah, fine. Let's do this assumption thing, and I will remember tomorrow. So general properties of wireless communication. I'm gonna tell you some common sense statements, and let's see if we agree. Communication mediated by real energy-carrying quanta. Oh, kind of, I told you though. Like, an emitter emits photons, a receiver captures photons. That seems reasonable, though. Regardless of what I told you, that seems reasonable, right? That's how you communicate. You emit light, someone captures that light. No? Agreed? So you need to emit photons, quanta that is real, carrying energy, and they need to be received. Information flows are carried, on average, by energy flows, right? To communicate, you need to send energy somehow, on average, anyways. Maybe you can agree that you do nothing if A, and I do something if B. But on average, if A and B have some non-zero probability of happening, you'll have to pay some energy. So information reaches you when the energy reaches you, right? I send energy, the energy laser beam hits you. The moment it hits you, information hits you, right? Common sense. Another one, communication is only possible for massless fields, right? Why is that it? Well, anyway, we're gonna have to deal with it. Only possible at the speed of light. I mean, of course, not faster, but also not slower. Like, light propagates at the speed of light, not slower. If you communicate with rocks, sure, you can signal the future light cone, but maybe you communicate with light, well, if you beam an empty chair, the beam is well gone. If you come 30 minutes later and you sit there, you're not gonna get it, right? So if you miss the beam, you miss the message. So some assumptions, right? That seem reasonable. Communication through massless, that's what I meant. Communication through massless fields, through a mass, oh my God, this is so wrong, that phrase. And this is gonna be recorded, feels so bad. Communication through a massless field in vacuum can only happen at the speed of light, right? Only through the exchange of real quanta. And information flow is carried by an energy flow. Of course, that means that you miss the beam, you miss the message. So what we will discuss in the next lecture is that in general, all those assumptions are not true. Not a single one of them. Some cases it's true, but in general, it won't be. And we'll analyze when it won't be, and when it will be, and why, and where those things come from, now that we have the math to do it. I won't need to wave my hand so much to convince you, because we've done this. Questions? All right. Well, if there are no questions, I'll see you tomorrow.